All right. And let me apologize for looking straight down, but trust me, things have gotten considerably better for your lives, probably for mine too, but especially for your lives when I put the stopwatch on. So I know how long I've been talking. All right. So once again, good morning, everybody. And, that was so hearty and in unison. I don't think we could do that again if we tried. It's very good to see everybody here this morning. If you have been with us so far, or even if you haven't, it's always good just to do a quick recap. Because over the year, we've been doing practicing the way, or what it actually looks like to tangibly follow Jesus. Because everybody will always say things about following Jesus, but sometimes it's hard to actually let the rubber meet the road. And so it's dissecting the things Jesus said about himself, things that the Old Testament highlights for us, and things that the apostles said. Here's the way Jesus did it. Now here's how you do that as a church. Because Paul even elaborated a lot on Jesus' lessons, because sometimes it's hard to take exactly what Jesus said from the Gospels, which is him and 12 dudes and a little menagerie of other people following him around, and say, now how do we do this in the middle of Greece with 150 people? Paul elaborates on a lot of that too. So we've just been going over those together, and starting last week, this week, and next week, we're talking about generosity. And Jimmy started us with generosity last week, and so I'm here to do week two. And we're going to take a slightly different look at some of this, rather than just finding all of the creative ways we can say you should be generous. We're going to take a look at the way generally that Jesus seemed to view resources and money, and then the way Paul tells us that we should practically follow that out in our lives, and what that might mean for us here now today. And just so you're aware, I love talking about cultural stuff. I'm a big nerd. The Godzilla sweater probably gives it away, but I'm a big nerd, and I went to school. Things. And truth be told, I'm going to hit a whole lot of cultural hot topics and big red shiny buttons that you're not supposed to push, but Jesus pushed those, so I'm going to push them. So that way, you know, if you don't like something I've said, it's David's fault. No, it's my fault. But generally speaking, when I push on these things, it's not because I just get a joy, any sort of particular joy out of like feeling like I'm putting a stab in between your ribs and wanting to kind of play around a little bit. I don't want to say or do anything transgressive for the sake of being transgressive. I just want to say, hey, here's what's going on in our culture. Here's what scripture points to in light of all those things, because it's nice to sit around and talk about what people did in, you know, 50 AD in light of Jesus' teachings. But we're sitting here in 2025. We need to really see how the rubber meets the road on a lot of these things, especially whenever it comes to talking about resources and money and wealth. And so if you hear me talk about a thing and I don't inherently criticize it, please don't think I'm endorsing it. And then if you hear me come over here on the opposite end of the thing and criticize a thing you really like, I might not be actively trying to tear it down. What I'm trying to point out to you is that there's no real economic system that the world has come up with or ever will come up with that's ever going to solve everybody's problems, because the only thing that can is Jesus. And also, I don't think we're ever going to have a perfect economic system until he comes again. Okay? So I'm just bracing you all for that. And then, like I said, if you have any other questions or thoughts or something is just burning in your side this whole time and you have to come find me afterward, come find me afterward. I'd love to talk with you about all this stuff. But this morning, we're going to mostly land in 1 Timothy in chapter 6. And we're going to start at verse 1, but I think this is, if you don't, because I'm going to be talking about a lot of passages this morning, and you don't really need to memorize everything I'm talking about. But if you take away one thing from this morning, take away 1 Timothy 6. And it's the first 11 verses that we're going to be looking at. And granted, Paul is writing this to Timothy, a pastor specifically. But there's a lot of principles from this that still just apply to the church and all of us in our everyday lives. Because there's nothing that Paul says here that he either isn't telling Timothy to go tell to the church writ large, or that you shouldn't follow even though you're not a pastor. So we're going to look at this here. It says, starting at chapter 6, "Let all who are under a yoke as bond servants regard their own masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and the teaching may not be reviled. Those who have believing masters must not be disrespectful on the ground that they are brothers. Rather, they must serve all the better, since those who benefit by their good service are believers and beloved. Teach and urge these things. If anyone teaches a different doctrine and does not agree with the sound words of our Lord Jesus Christ and the teaching that accords with godliness, he is puffed up with conceit and understands nothing. He has an unhealthy craving for controversy and for quarrels about words, which produce envy, dissension, slander, evil suspicions, and constant friction among the people who are depraved in mind and depraved of the truth, imagining that godliness is a means of gain. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of this world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. But as for you, O man of God, flee these things. Pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, steadfastness, and gentleness." So what we have here is Paul really getting at both ends of the spectrum. Because he begins by writing about wealth and resources by talking to the low class, those who've sold themselves into service. And yes, I do understand there's a whole like another 3 weeks worth of sermons we could do on the topic of bond servant and slavery in the Bible, because there are some things where there's overlap with our cultural context and there are huge chasms in our cultural context. That's a whole different point. For right now, understand that these people have made a contract with somebody to say, "I work for you for X amount of time," either because they borrowed money or because it's just like a salary contract. They didn't need the money, but they're new to the area, and so they want to start earning a wage, along those things. And those people were called bond servants. Some of your borrowed money, and now they also have to pay it back with interest. It's like a loan or a debt, but you're working. For us, we don't work for credit unions or for banks, not most of us, but it would be the same thing as you just started showing up every day to the credit union and started doing work in their lobby to pay off your loan rather than going to your regular job. Some of these are just contractual agreements, but he starts telling the low class who don't have a lot of resources, the very first thing that they're supposed to do is treat the people that they owe money to with all honor and dignity, especially if they're believers, because you don't get licensed to suddenly act snotty and snide that somebody loaned you money just because they're a believer, like they have to, out of obligation, not expect you to repay them. And that you're actually supposed to work all the harder. It's not a license to be slack either. And that you're supposed to work for that person as though you're working for God himself. Because you are. Because God sees everything that you're doing. And all the work you do in your whole life is a way of ministering to the world around you about him. And so if you slack, and if you don't pay back what you owe, what does that say about the God who saved you? Especially whenever he says he paid your price. Then it starts to make the outside world wonder how good of a price that God could actually pay. But then he comes all the way over to the other end of the spectrum and tells wealthy individuals, you have to be careful of this temptation of acquiring more things, because it's an appetite that never ends. And most people actually tend to misquote that passage. I bet you probably heard the quote, money is the root of... There you go. See, y'all said it wrong. Right. Money is not the root of all evil. Paul wrote, money is the root of many kinds of evils. the love of it specifically, not just it existing. Because I don't know if you know this, money is literally just a tool. It doesn't actually exist. It doesn't actually exist. 80% of the money in the world is completely made up. It's binary code that sits on computers. If you had a ton of money, and I mean a lot of money, with a whole lot of zeros, and you walked into an average bank and said, I want to cash all that out, they would have a panic attack. They would probably tell you no, and then you would have to go into an office, and they're going to grill you to make sure it's actually yours. You could walk in there with everything and like a retinal scan, and they'll still be like, we're uncomfortable with this. But all at the same time, that's why they have to do insurance on banks, because if everybody shows up to the bank all at one time and wants all their money back, the bank doesn't actually have physical bills to give everybody. And that's how we have a bank run and a panic. It's a tool. And it's largely a tool so that way everybody has something that's tradable. All right, so let's say I am a blacksmith and I'm very, very good at making horseshoes. And I come into a town about, I don't know, yay big, it's Jeff City, and there's already 5 blacksmiths, and they don't really need another one. But the only thing I have to give everybody is a bunch of horseshoes. I have nothing to trade with. I'll starve. So I either pack up and move to another town and wander around until I find some place with a lack of horseshoes, or I have to find something else I can trade. Hence, money. Also, money is small. Right, so let's say back in the ancient world, you were a cattle farmer. If you had to pack up 1,000 cattle and move them from one really hot place in the Middle East to another, you have all kinds of logistical problems. Cattle wandering off, cattle getting sick and dying, one of them tripping in whatever the Middle Eastern equivalent of a gopher hole is, because I know that's a problem around here if cattle fall into a hole and break their ankle. That you have to worry about everything. Bandits, snakes, any possible thing that could go wrong. And you know what's a lot easier to tote than 1,000 cattle? A sack of gold. And everybody will take gold, but not everybody always needs cattle. Money was just created as a universal tradable good. That's it. It's easier to pack. It's more discreet. Everybody needs it. That's all it's supposed to be. A resource, a tool, like anything else. But since it represents resources and the world needs resources, clearly the world kind of runs on it because everybody's trading it all the time to make things go. But in our culture, because in America in 2025, there is no longer such a thing as nuance. And there's no longer such a thing as, you know, the fundamental reality that multiple things can all be true at the same time. We seem to have forgotten that. And there is a binary scale in the ways in which you can think about money. You don't get, there's no in between. There's one point or the other. And I have a visual representation of this scale for you, and you can pick which camp you want to be in. Okay, wait, are we ready? Here's the scale. This is your choice. Pick a team. Right? And just so you're aware, this is Scrooge before the ghosts visit him, okay? You don't get the out. This isn't nice Scrooge at the end of the story. We're talking pre-ghost Scrooge. These are your picks. Pick one, right? So all the way on the way right end, you have the idea of money is inherently a structure to show that to separate the wheat from the chaff. If you're useful, if you're worthy of survival, you're going to have it. And as Scrooge talked about the poor people in the Christmas Carol, if you don't have it, you can either go into the prison or die because you're wasting everybody else's time. That was his posture on things. And there are a whole lot of people in the world that would genuinely believe, or at least in our cultural context, that if you have a certain amount of digits in your bank account, you automatically and magically become that dude, no matter who you are. There's no nuance. There's no caveats. It doesn't matter how much you give to charity. There's a whole host of people that will assume you're that dude. You're stealing everything from everybody because you have it and I don't, and you want me to die, even though they have no idea who you are. And then all the way on this end of the spectrum right over here, you've got the radical, there's no such thing as private ownership of anything. If you have something privately, that's because you did in fact steal it, and everybody should own it all at once. And there are a whole lot of people in our current cultural climate and context that would assume if you support any kind of social safety net at all, you automatically are a dye-in-the-wool communist. You filthy red. Right? We took y'all out in the 90s. Stay away. Like, that's the posture a lot of people have. And you only get to exist on one end or the other. There's nothing in between. And it's really easy to, even if you actually do, like a normal human being, exist somewhere on the in-between of my silly and very dumb scale back here. That's not actual reality, but it's the way social media and politicians and news figureheads and people who make a lot of money by keeping your attention would like you to think things are, because your attention is their currency. And there's nothing that keeps your attention longer than either being afraid or being angry or some cocktail of both. And so this is the wonderful climate that we get to live in. And I would like to have you know, Jesus and his teachings don't really support either end of this spectrum. And I'm not going to say it falls somewhere in between, because like I said, this is a silly scale that doesn't actually exist in reality. But rather, we're just going to look at what Paul talks about and what Jesus was saying and what we see in the Old Testament and say, okay, how should we actually think about this? We can take the silly picture away, Wade. I mean, unless you all just like looking at their handsome faces. And so in the Old Testament, God set up a very specific set of laws in the Torah. And you're going to find a lot of interesting stuff in the Torah. Now, here's the thing you need to understand about the Old Testament, and especially the Torah, that a lot of people might try to attack Christianity over, or you might have some confusion over, but let me lift a weight off of your shoulders. The Torah is not meant to be a guide on how to create utopia on earth. If you see laws or rules or regulations in there that don't make any sense, that make you feel squeamish, that's easy for people to attack, understand this was God making a specific covenant with a specific people at a point in time. Not with you and I sitting here today. The Torah was a specific covenant to the Jews at that time. And even then, it wasn't God trying to create a utopia, that this is exactly how everything in the world should be, because the whole sacrificial system was dependent on things dying for you to be cleansed. The whole thing was so that people could be in a state of ritual cleanliness so they could actually go into the temple and be with God. That was the whole point. But it's not a perfect system to create a perfect society. But even in its imperfection, and I mean this in the general sense of the term, not our cultural modern context with a big P. I mean with like a little p. The Torah, for all of the things that might make 2025 people want to go, ugh, because it crosses our sensibilities, is a radically progressive document. This is a document that looked at an ancient world where might makes right, and if you don't have enough swords, you no longer have anything, because we will conquer you. Your stuff is now ours. We kill all the men, and the women and the children either work, and work either in the fields or in the world's oldest occupation, if you will, or you die. Those are your options. That's it. That's all. And yet, even inside of societies, if you were a woman and whoever your patriarch was died, and there weren't enough family resources to keep you going, and you were just a normal middle-class working person back in the day, you either starve, sell your children off one by one into slavery, or you yourself, once again, take the world's oldest occupation. And that's it. Those are your options. And yet the Torah changes all of that. And even all of the ick that we might feel about the conquest as 2025 Americans, God changed all of the rules of combat. And one of the number one things he said was, by the way, you don't get to just pillage women and children. You don't get to do that. if combatants will die, that is what it is. And there were other casualties because combat is terrible. I don't mean for that to sound callous, but it's just the truth of war. But they weren't allowed to just treat the women afterward like garbage. Somebody was told, no, if a lady catches your eye, you have to marry her. You don't get to use up a woman and then throw her out into the wilderness. You don't get to just treat children like chattel. It changed the way you treat wartime enemies and people who weren't combatants. If you were a woman and your husband died or your father died, they created a whole safety net program called the Goel system. The whole book of Ruth is based around it, where your nearest relative, usually your brother-in-law, had to take care of you as though you were his spouse, and then preserve your husband's inheritance for your kids and make sure they got it and that it was still in your husband's name. And it didn't automatically get absorbed into the brother-in-law's household. Your stuff was yours. And it was your family's job or your nearest relative's job. It could be an obscure relative, because in the book of Ruth, Boaz kind of had to hunt down somebody who was like, who? Who's Ruth? Okay, yeah, I guess take care of her, man. He was probably very confused. But it set up systems for people to be cared for. And then it also, at the very beginning of the law, teaches you the kind of mentality you should have about resources. Also, that for everybody, not just the higher the low, but everybody. So in Exodus 20, and that's where we find the Ten Commandments. And one of those commandments is, you will not covet your neighbor's belongings, spouse, or property. God gave it to them, and he gave you what's yours. Be content. And then he also had things like this. So this is a part of what Jesus quotes, actually, in Leviticus. If you think Leviticus is nothing but blood, guts, boils, and boring, Jesus quotes it as having the second greatest commandment in all of Scripture. And there's more in there than just that. There is narrative and some other stuff. But in Leviticus 19, we see this, another one of these radically progressive passages about how you're supposed to actually farm and take care of things. Let's see here, and loving your neighbor as yourself. And it says this, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field up to its edge, neither shall you gather the gleanings from your harvest, and you shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. It was your field. It was yours by all rights. You had the deed to it. But God is telling you that when you harvest, because plots of land are more easily sold as a square, and when you're plowing, I don't know if you know this, cattle and horses, they don't walk in 90-degree angles. That's not a thing that happens. There were no ZTR mowers in ancient Israel. You're going to turn, and it's going to be a nice gradual turn, and you're going to have this whole corner that you're now going to have to plow and thresh and do everything else by hand, because your plower just can't reach it. And God is telling you, those bits that the cattle and your plower can't reach, those aren't yours. They're mine. And I'm telling you that I'm giving part of what I've blessed you with to the lower class and the sojourner. And immediately our gut instinct is to be like, hey, now. And God knows that, because he ends the passage by saying, I'm doing it. I'm God. Because he knows our gut reaction is to say, that's mine. And God says, no, it's mine. And I'm telling you to do something with a small portion of it. Not the whole field, just the bits that your cow or your horse can't reach. And a little bit later in Leviticus 25, it gets even more explicit than that. Check this out. If your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. So it's not even just if you're a woman and your husband has died and you're on the verge of being destitute that a redeemer is supposed to come along. It's that if you have somebody that you love and you care about, and you see them slowly going destitute over time, and they've had to sell everything they have to give to their children, and now they're about ready to go into bondage because God had very strong feelings about any Israelite ever being a slave ever again. He commanded his people to step in, and whoever the nearest redeemer is, buy the property. And after X amount of time, if you can afford to give it back to them up front, you give it back to them up front. Or you hang on to it until the next year of Jubilee, and then it's theirs again. It was the same thing that if you had to enter into a bondservant contract, that you would work for somebody, and you would work hard. Not lazily, but hard. And God was very explicit that whoever has your bondservant contract is never to abuse you. And no matter how long you've been in this contract or not, at the year of Jubilee, your total debt would be wiped out. And there were even provisions given in the law to say, and for my cheeky followers, this was from Yahweh, I'm paraphrasing if you will, because I don't think you're going to find the word cheeky anywhere in Hebrew. But for my more cheeky followers who decide that they don't want to do that, you're not allowed to not hire people in the year of Jubilee because you don't want to, quote unquote, waste money. You're supposed to do all of your economic things just as you always would, and whether you hired that person 6.99 years ago or whether you hired them yesterday, their total debt is wiped out and they go free. Why? Because I am the Lord. I freed you. You will free other people as I command. That was the whole justification. And there's a whole string of laws like that. That if you're, here's another one. If your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner, and he shall live with you. Take no interest from him or profit, but fear your God. But all at the same time, there are a ton of laws about how to do commerce, about not cheating wealth, about behaving mercifully toward whoever held your contract. That you were supposed to actually work hard because they aren't going to slave drive you. They're your brother or sister, dear Israelite. So work as though you're working for God. And we get a similar command from Paul all the way in the New Testament. And I think some of the passages that would really help clarify some of this, we'll read in just a moment. But it becomes deeply, deeply uncomfortable for us in 2025, real quick, whenever we start touching on all these things. Because like I said, we hear words like bond servant or laborer or person who owes another person interest. And there's a whole group of us that would immediately in 2025, and by us, I mean us, not people in this room, please hear me out, that automatically assume, nope, that's bad, that's evil, just give people stuff. Just give it to them. It's fine. You got enough of it. It's fine. Just don't be stingy. Don't be greedy. And yet all at the same time, whenever we evaluate the passage, it doesn't tell your brother just fork something over because it looks like somebody needed it. There was still the understanding of they're coming to you and they're going to work. And because you're giving them a resource, they should give you something. You didn't have to. You could charitably just give something to people in the Old Testament. But God, at never any point does he ever say it's immoral or harmful or bad that a person of means in ancient Israelite society should expect somebody to do something for the resource. He just outlines that, hey, you don't abuse people to earn resources. Just have them do what normally happens. Let them be like any other person. Treat them like anybody else. And it really, it traps us, you know, like I said, it feels like we're this binary once again in our culture where you can only have one view or the other, and yet the Bible doesn't have either of those views. Rather, it takes this view, because this is what, I'm going to read something to you from 1 Chronicles, whenever David, he prays in front of all the people, the richest, wealthiest man, the best fighter, the best looking dude in the whole land, who owned a whole lot of stuff in his life. All right, understand this. If you think that there's something somehow immoral just about inherently owning things and a lot of things, understand, David had more stuff than you. Probably way more stuff than anybody you've ever met, unless you are like hobnobbing with Fortune 500 billionaires all the time, which I don't think any of you all are. You might surprise me, but I don't think any of you all are. He had way more stuff than anybody here, and yet God called him a man after my own heart. But he prays this prayer publicly before all of Israel in 1 Chronicles. It says, "Therefore David blessed the Lord in the presence of all of the assembly, and David said, 'Blessed are you, O Lord, the God of Israel, our Father, forever and ever. Yours, O Lord, is the greatest and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. For all that is in the heavens and on the earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and you are exalted as head above all. Both riches and honor come from you, and you rule over all. In your hand are power and might, and in your hand is to make great and to give strength to all. And now we thank you, our God, and praise your glorious name. But who am I and what is my people that we should be able to thus offer to you so willingly? For all things come from you, and of your own we have given back to you." And rather, both ends of our cultural spectrum have the complete wrong starting point, because everybody wants to sit around and argue about, philosophically, about economics and property. And one end of the spectrum will tell you all property is evil and should be communally owned. The other end of the spectrum will tell you that private property is everything. And it's the only way in which we could ever have justice. And yet God tells his people all throughout this book, everything is his property. And he gives and takes away as he will. And we are momentary stewards of that property. And if you have an awful lot of property, more than you need, which usually tends to be the case with most folks in America. Not that inflation is not very real or that times don't get real tight and really, really hard, because my personal grocery bill is still through the roof compared to what it used to be just 6 years ago. Right? The Aldi bags are the same size and the receipt's getting longer. But all at the same time, I still have way more than I need. And it's very, very tempting whenever times get tight and the receipts keep getting longer and nobody has any good options and things feel stagnant and you're watching the tickers go up and down if you have a portfolio and all these things, and the tension happens. I promise you, whatever our tax rate is right now, it's probably not comparable to the tax gouging that happened in the Roman Empire. Theirs was probably a tad worse. And at least you get to complain about taxes and air conditioning. These people didn't. And it's easy to just personalize faith because times are getting hard. And so you come to the words of Scripture, and you come to church because you just need some comfort and peace because things are getting very, very uncomfortable very, very fast. And I get it. I really do. But all at the same time, we're told this. It's in James, and we'll have it up on the screen. It's from James 2. And this gets rough. What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace and be warm and be filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. And to save a whole big long theological argument, no, the book of James is not about earning salvation, because one of the best quotes I've ever heard came from the late Vodi Bakum of saying the gospel does not require obedience, but it does create it. That sometimes they will know you by your love costs you something. And that's okay, because the edges of the field don't belong to you. I'm not telling you to walk in here, sign your whole house over, and we're going to live somewhere together on a farm like a cult. I'm saying you have corners in your field, and God says they're his. And even God recognizes the value of social safety nets, of saying there are people who have need. I helped you when you were needy. Go help others who are needy. And understand that spectrum doesn't just apply to people with a whole lot more digits in their bank account than you, because one of the greatest lessons on wealth Jesus ever taught was when a poor woman still tithed out of her poverty, and he said that she is more righteous than anybody who dumped in a ton of money, because they're still probably not fully cleaning out the corners of their field. They're leaving all the corners of their field for the poor. They just want to feel better about the fact that they put in a large sum. There was an expectation by God in the Old Testament and by Jesus in the New that no matter where you're at, you have corners somewhere that belong to God. But the other end of that spectrum still exists. So catch this in 2 Thessalonians, because Paul, if you all think, I mean, James gets the reputation for being the roughest epistle to read and deal with, but Paul can really mess you up sometimes. He can be kind of rude, politely rude. And he says this in 2 Thessalonians. We'll also have this on the screen, starting in chapter 3 at verse 6. Now we command you, brothers, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you keep away from any brother who is walking in idleness and not in accord with the tradition that you have received from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to imitate us, because we are not idle when we were with you, nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it. But with toil and labor, we worked night and day that we might not be a burden to any of you. It was not because we do not have that right, meaning we were your preachers. We have a right to ask you to pay us a tithe. But Paul, in this case, willingly forewent payment to be an example to them. And he said, but to give you in ourselves an example to imitate. For even when we were with you, we would give you this command. And catch this, if anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat. For we hear that some among you walk in idleness, not busy at work, but busybodies. Now, such persons we command and encourage you in the Lord Christ to do their work quietly and to earn their own living. As for you, brothers, do not grow weary of doing good. And if anyone does not obey what we say in this letter, take note of that person and have nothing to do with him, that he may be ashamed. And Paul specifically was telling you that if you know somebody, not somebody who's down and out and genuinely has a hard time in life and really needs help, but somebody who's just not willing to do something. And especially those who are believers who are trying to say, well, God says you're supposed to take care of me because I'm a brother. If you are trying to take advantage of God's bride, he does not take kindly to that. And he tells you, you don't eat. We get to live in this fun tension of that God tells his people to be wise and shrewd with their resources. And there's this misconception that because a bunch of people in Acts sold a bunch of their stuff and gave it to the church, that then we must all live in some fanciful commune and having things is immoral if you're a believer. That's far from the truth. At no point does Jesus teach that. He actually taught a number of parables. One of them was all about having your investment grow bigger and expecting a return on investment. If y'all didn't think Jesus preached about ROI, it's one of the most famous parables. Jesus taught a lot about money. Paul teaches a lot about money. And at no point does this faith false binary ever come up of you are somehow inherently blessed and everything you're doing is right because you have a lot of stuff, nor is there this other end of the spectrum where you are somehow inherently virtuous because you have nothing and you're like a monk. Maybe you're just idle and nobody's paying you because you're not willing to do a thing. And I know I managed a nonprofit for 6 years. I've seen both ends of the spectrum. And sometimes people don't want to believe me. I have a lot of very loving and charitable brothers and sisters who do a lot of work in nonprofit, and they're passionate about working with people who are in extreme poverty. And trust me, I care about it. I participate in all of our unhoused stuff here. I really care about it. And I also worked in nonprofit long enough to know the difference of there were those who came in who needed my help, and there were those who came in to take advantage of the fact that we had resources. And I'm not saying that's all of those people who need help, and I'm not saying that it's even the majority of them. But for my brothers and sisters who are very charitably minded, understand that we are also called to be wise and discerning in how we do our charity. And so stopping for just a moment to say, let's evaluate what we're doing, is actually wisdom from people who have resources. They have them for a reason. God gave them resources for a reason. Maybe they're good at managing it. And so maybe we actually need each other. Because whenever we have a lot of resources and we're excellent at managing them, and God keeps giving us to us because we steward them well, we're used to just making the numbers go up. Make them get bigger, because that's good. And it is good. And maybe we need the charitably minded brothers and sisters to remind us the corners are looking a little full this year. Let's give them to somebody else because we're fine. And yet also, my more charitably minded brothers and sisters, please remember, idleness has been around since the beginning of the world. And there are genuinely those who are unwilling to do something. And even Paul, who probably was more charitable than any of us in this room, at a point would say, you no longer get my charity if you are unwilling to do anything. Because ultimately, everything belongs to God. And having much should not make you stingy or mistrusting of somebody who needs something. Because you're probably doing something right if you have much. And God is apparently trusting you with much. Now you get to trust him with just the corners. And then for those of you who don't have much, understand God doesn't hate you in comparison to anybody else. Maybe you don't have much because it's just a really hard season in life. And maybe you're too proud to ask other people in the room for a kinsman redeemer. But we're here to help you. So come talk to us. But also, you're not allowed to be bitter just because somebody else has more stuff than you. Be content with what you have, either in much or in little. Because the only thing that's going to fix this is viewing money and resources from God's perspective. There's no amount of diversification, of crypto, of gold, of cash, of whatever else you want to have on hand that will ever make you feel secure like you have enough. There's no amount of government or local nonprofit that's ever going to solve the problems of poverty, and yet God still says, give the corners. And I don't have all the answers, and we don't have all the time, because I could keep going. But please just understand, if I could summarize it and bring it, even ground it just back to some things that even specifically Jesus said, if your disposition is to be inherently mistrusting of charitable things or having some sort of safety net or providing for those things, please understand that whenever Jesus specifically chided Judas, just Judas, and said, the poor will always be among you, I've heard that recited by a whole lot of people who are way better at money than me. That was not license for them to you to not be charitable, because he was talking to specifically Judas, who we all know was going to probably sell the nard to steal the money. It wasn't an excuse to not give. But then also, for any of you who are on the other end of the spectrum, Jesus only ever told one specific guy to sell all you have and give it to the poor, because he thought he could purchase heaven. God is interested in his perspective, not our social, political ideas and philosophies and theories about how to fix the American economy in 2025. I don't have those answers. I don't know if anybody really does, but all at the same time, just as a pastor, I'm just here to help us individually and corporately view money from God's perspective. And it's all his. That's the Bible's perspective. It's not yours, it's his. So I'm going to read this last little bit from First Chronicles again, of what David said. But who am I, and what is my people, that we should be able to make an offering to you so willingly? For all things come from you, and of your own we have given back to you. So in this time of response, if the band would like to come up, and I did not manage to grab Adam and Jimmy before the service, if you all don't mind being available on the front row for response, because both David and I will be preoccupied during the music. But I would encourage you to really sit back and think about that. Let go of your social, political priors for just a little bit and evaluate, what does it mean for everything that I have to truly be God's? And evaluate where your corners are and see if there's not a way that you can be more generous. But then also know it's okay to be wise and slow down and think about what you're doing before you do it. Because God wants his people to be shrewd along with incredibly generous. And here's the one big thing that we have to shatter. I know I'm running long, and I'm so sorry about that. But in our culture, we have this weird taboo about talking about money, especially in church, but like, period. Talk about your money with other people. You don't have to talk about your money with everybody. But if you're a brother or sister, grab somebody that you trust and talk about your money with them. Because you need somebody else in your life to hold you accountable for either your wisdom or your bad decisions. Because somebody else could probably help you see your corners a little bit easier than you can, especially when times are tight. But just share with one another and talk about it. Try to find where those corners are and try to let go. Scrutinize where you're giving it. Two, don't just be like, oh, that looks good, let's just throw some money at that. Figure out what things God is blessing and give money to that. So just evaluate. If you need to, go find a budget accountability partner or another couple or another person and figure out where the corners are. and trust God, because it's all his property anyways. So let's worship a little bit more this morning. It is also this morning Lord's Supper. And so if during this time of response, also feel free to come up and grab your elements. If whoever our deacons are who are watching the elements this morning wouldn't mind coming forward. Feel free also during the time of response to come grab your elements, and then after response is over, we will partake in the Lord's Supper together.